You are listening to Middle East Monitor Conversations, bringing you lively discussions with prominent voices from the region and beyond, as we delve deeper into issues shaping the Middle East and North Africa, from politics to culture and the arts.
Hello, welcome to Memo Conversations. I'm video producer Osman Butt. When you say the word Persian, the first thing that comes to mind is Iran and Iranian culture. And in our modern times, this territorial ethno-nationalist understanding is the dominant approach. But being Persian through this lens is very modern. Prior to the 19th century, the Persianate, a term used by scholars to describe a range of geographies, cultures, ethnicities, and religions who shared aspects of the Persian language, system of meaning, and culture as part of their own culture, stretched from Istanbul, Baghdad, Isfahan, Hyderabad, Lahore, Kabul, Sarakand, and beyond. Central Asia was a key part of the Persianate. However, over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, with Russian colonization and later Soviet rule, the Central Asian Persianate underwent serious challenges. So what is the Central Asian Persianate, and how does it exist today? Joining me to answer this question is Iskander Ding. Iskander Ding is a third-year PhD student at SOAS University of London. His doctorate project focuses on the syntax of the Yanhubia language, the only living descendant of the Songdian spoken in Tajikistan. His research interests include linguistics of Iranian and Turkic languages, Persian dialectology, as well as Persianate literature and culture from the Balkans to South Asia. Iskander, welcome to Memo Conversations.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Osman.
And I don't think you'll do as badly as I did trying to pronounce some of that. I apologize.
No, it is
indeed.
Yeah, these are very poor transliterations into English. I have to say, so you know, it's not a big deal if you can't pronounce them correctly.
Well, the worst is French.
Right.
Whenever I have a French word, I'm just like, what is this?
Yeah. Don't pronounce what you pronounce, you know.
Yeah, that's just how I do it. You have to love it or hate it. So before we sort of get into how you got into the sort of areas of studies that you're in, could you perhaps tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what sort of made you interested in, you know, things like linguistics, language, literature of Central Asia, the Persianate, as well as, you know, the cultures that are connected to it?
Yeah, sure. I am from China. And I'm from the Hui Muslim ethnic group in China, which is the biggest of the 10 officially designated Muslim groups in China in terms of population. The Hui are Sinophone or let's Chinese speaking Muslims with mixed ancestry. And usually our ancestors who came to China throughout the centuries came from specifically the eastern part of the Islamic world. So let's say Khorasan, which is now eastern Iran, Afghanistan, and what we now call Central Asia. And these were a mixed group of people, a mixture of different peoples, but mainly Persian would be the lingua franca between them. And many scholars have postulated that the majority of these people were indeed Persian speakers themselves. And even if they were not Persian speakers, Persian was the most important language in terms of communication. And they came to China for different reasons, for administrative reasons, for commercial reasons, probably also for proselytizing reasons, and settled and married local Chinese people, and that's the ethnogenesis of the Hui people. And in our communities, Arabic and Persian have always been very important, and we see them as languages of identity, of religion. You know, religion is a big part of our identity, and of course, wisdom, and especially Persian And because, well, Persian was actually perceived as the, well, it was actually referred to as the Muslim language. The term Hui actually in Chinese came to mean Muslim at a certain period of the history. Historically meant different things. I won't go into details. And even Jews and Christians at a certain point were called Hui. This is true, but it came to mean to designate Muslims predominantly. And the Hui language, Huihui in Chinese, referred precisely to Persian. And I suppose because of this, I see myself as a descendant of the Persian world who grew up in a Sinophone world. Now we're talking about two, if I have to use the German term, Kulturkreis, so cultural spheres, which in history bordered each other and still now, in fact, border each other, although we now have nation states. So I felt this urge, and I thought it was important for me to be both proficient in Chinese and Persian, and as well as to learn other Persian languages.
So is there now a sort of consensus on who the Hui are? Because I know this has been a very highly debated topic. I mean, just sort of to recap, so for the audience, I mean, there's about, what, 55, 56 ethnicities in officially classed in China,
56, 50,
56, the largest being Han Chinese, and the Han being the largest is also dominant. You know, the Chinese state is constructed around Han identity, and especially in the 20th century, there's been a huge push towards the Hanonization of much of China, in terms of, you know, official culture and statehood and that kind of thing. But there was always a debate about who the Hui were and whether or not they were just Muslim Hans, is or whether they were, you know, from elsewhere. So is there now sort of consensus on what their origins are?
There's no consensus. I think in the in academia, of course, and as well as in public, every claim has its, I don't want to use this word, but ideological background. But I think it's very important to ask the Hui themselves or ourselves what we think of this term. And I think the definition has to come, well, part of the definition has to come from us. Of course, the Western scholars who see language as the biggest, as the main, let's say, criterion in the definition of an ethnic group. We speak Chinese as our mother tongue, so very almost in a very simplistic way, Western scholars see as, and indeed media see us as Chinese Muslims. And there's a lot of things to unpack here, actually. First of all, what does what does China, what the term Chinese means in the majority of Western languages, not just Western languages, you know, in Arabic Sini and in Persian Chini. There's only one word for Chinese, and that's inevitably ethnic. And but in China, natively, there are different terms and which exist and still exist, to which all get translated into Chinese or Xinhua or Chinesisch or Kitaisky in Russian or Chini in Persian and so on and so forth. Precisely because China and people in what is now China recognize their, let's say, space of existence as a multicultural one, and they're different terms to designate people who belong to that land, who may not necessarily be ethnically, well, this is probably a sort of, you know, anachronistic term to use here, but for convenience, I'm using it. Yeah, who recognize the diversity, let's say, within it. So there are different terms which all get translated to Chinese. Whilst unfortunately, because people from the West tend to perceive China as a monolithic, ethnically monolithic entity. The term Chinese has been fixated on the Chinese ethnicity, whereas it doesn't have to be so. So let's say, if we take the term Chinese to be to mean ethnically Chinese, ethnic, so let's say Han Muslims, from our perspective, and also from the perspective of the Chinese government, who officially designated the 56 ethnic groups, they are not classified, they're not recognized by us as Hui, and they're not recognized by the Chinese state as Hui. It's not like when a Chinese person, well, when a Han Chinese person converts to Islam, they change their ethnicity on their ID. In China, there are ID cards, and ID cards show your ethnicity. And they can't do that because it's not recognized by the Chinese state whatsoever. In that sense, no, Huis are not. Being Hui is, I always say to people that you have to have a history. Yeah, there's a family tradition. Whether we now look like Chinese people or not, it is very important that that our ancestry, no matter how far back in history, came from elsewhere, and that narrative, that discourse, no matter what Western scholars think of it, is very important to our identity. And Han Chinese people can't convert to Islam, lack that family tradition, which I suppose already disqualifies them as some Hui. But in terms of historical reality, possibly from the Western perspective, 500 years of history, 600 years of history, 700 years of history is already enough to wash out, let's say, your genetic pool. But for within the Chinese cultural context, I suppose that's ironically how we are Chinese. Ancestry is very, very important. So for us, that's still very important. It's still relevant. In terms of culture, in obviously Hui people in China, different Hui communities have different cultures. And the more west you go in China, the more Hui communities you have, and the more, let's say, conservative people tend to be in their ethno-religious expression. There is a traditional importance of the use of the Arabic and Persian languages. And in fact, until the establishment of the modern Chinese state, a lot of people wouldn't be able to write in Chinese characters, and they would write the Chinese characters in the Arabic script called Xiao'erjing, which is a system of writing Chinese in the Perso-Arabic script. And there are many, many factors. I mean, many, many families have a story about how they came to China, how their foreign ancestors came to China. So, and it's very, very extremely well documented that prior to Islam, even after after Islam, people from lands west to China, especially Iranian-speaking peoples, not just Persians, settled in China and mixed with local populations, and this group of people may well, and this is very significant in Chinese history. So there is history to testify to it, and based on this, I would say that no. Hui Muslims are by no means simply converts, ethnically Chinese, ethnic Chinese converts.
Yes, there's a very complex history because, of course, as you know, anyone who, even if you don't know much about history, you've heard of Silk Roads, you've heard of all these trade routes, you've heard of all sorts of things. And so, much like the Middle East itself, China is a highly diverse society and historically and so forth. But when it comes to sort of language, I mean, how many languages do you actually speak?
Well, I actually hate this question because I don't know how to answer this. Depending on the situation, my fluency kind of differs. But I think fluently, well, the languages which I use daily, and if you chat to me, I can speak fluently and discuss politics or some sort of philosophy with you. Probably five or six. But I know how to read in about 20 languages, mainly through comparison. I mean, if you know one language, and if you have a linguistic mind, I'm a linguistic nerd. Well, If you know one language, you tend to compare it with languages which are related to it, and then you learn these languages as well. If not speaking, at least reading. So I can read and understand and about 20 languages, but spoken fluency wise, only five or six.
Oh, well, you're a true polyglot in that sense. Then you should, you. I wonder what you won't make of the whole YouTube polyglot space.
Oh well, we'll have to make another video about this.
Yes, indeed, indeed, indeed. What are these five? So I take it's obviously English,
English,
Mandarin. If I had
Mandarin,
to,
Chinese, Persian,
what else? Persian.
Uyghur, which I learned myself, and Russian. So how much is that? These are the languages which I tend to use every day, due to what I do. And now I speak Yahnobi. I wouldn't
Yes.
be fluent, but because I don't live in a community to speak to people.
We're going to get on to that particular language because I've got questions about it. But it's
Yes.
interesting. So, how does, say, Mandarin compare to, say, Cantonese for someone who's obviously don't speak the languages, but how do they compare?
Yes. Well, first of all, I have to point out that please, when you meet well, to the audience, I suppose, please, when you meet a Chinese person, when they say they speak Chinese, please don't ask, do you speak Mandarin or Cantonese? Because in China, there are many, many, many languages, even within the what we call in linguistics, Sinitic, so Chinese language group. I mean, with Mandarin and Cantonese is, I wouldn't even say that it's the, well, it is one of the most important Chinese languages, but I'm not sure whether it's the biggest. I have to sort of have a look. There are Chinese languages equally as important. No, I only speak Mandarin to answer your question first. But in China, different regional Chinese varieties, let's say Sinitic varieties, are usually referred to as dialects. And of course, we all know that a language is a dialect with a with an army and a navy, to quote a famous saying. And many of these varieties are very similar to each other, but many of them are very, very different from each other. And Chinese, well, Mandarin and Cantonese are very, very different from each other. They are two different languages, I would say, by let's say Western standards and Western academic standards, at least. Yes, they are not mutually intelligible, but it also depends on the register. So I can understand a little bit of Cantonese when it is spoken formally and slowly. Otherwise, I don't. So they are
So what you're
not.
saying here is if your friends take you on holiday to Hong Kong, just don't expect you to understand everything that's happening around you.
90% of the things said, I won't understand. So they are very, very different languages.
I won't sort of ask a question about this particular point, because as you mentioned, historically they would write Mandarin in Arabic in the Hui community, but
Yeah.
obviously Chinese is a Mandarin is a very different language, different structures. There's obviously, characters rather than an alphabet. There's it's tonal as well. So, how are these sort of complexities of these languages translated into a Persian Arabic script?
The tonality is not reflected in the Chinese script, in the Chinese characters anyway. So Chinese people have never written tones. I have to pause for a minute because I don't want to say the wrong thing because I'm not an expert in, I'm just a native speaker of Mandarin Chinese. I'm not an expert in Chinese philology. But no, in the Chinese writing, Chinese characters don't indicate tonality. And that was because when the Chinese characters were first developed, 3,000 years ago, I think, Chinese didn't have tones, or didn't have this tone system that we know it today. So that's no problem if you want to change a script or whatever. The Perso-Arabic script is more malleable, I think, than people realize. I think at the start of the 19th, well, at the start of the 20th century, end of the 19th century, a lot of reformers in the Muslim world try to classify the Perso-Chinese alphabet as backward and unscientific and inaccurate because Semitic scripts don't represent short vowels. But you can modify it, as many cultures have done. For example, the Perso-Arabic script was used to write Slavic in Bosnia and also in Belarus by the Tatar population, and it had it, it it the script has been adopted by many subcontinental Muslims to write their own languages, which have a bigger inventory of phonemes, of sounds, than the original Arabic letters. And yes, you can modify it, and that's what the Anhui Muslims did. Short vowels are written with tashkil, with the vocalization signs already existent in Arabic, and dots are added to represent different consonants and so on and so forth. And yeah, so that's how it is. And also, what is really interesting in Shaarjing, in the Perso-Arabic writing system for Chinese, is that people would use heterograms, which refer to a system of writing using the graph of a foreign language, but representing native words. Very similar to how the Japanese use Chinese characters, what the Japanese call kanji. These are Chinese characters, but they represent sometimes they're pronounced in the Chinese way, but other times they're not pronounced in the Chinese way. And then a significant number of Persian Arabic words are written down in Chinese texts as they are, but when people read the text, they would read in Chinese. And sometimes these words would be only used for their phonetic values to represent Chinese words which have nothing to do with the original meanings of the words used. So it's a complex and fascinating way of writing, but yes, people did manage.
Yes, the people always find a way. So I want to now bring us on to Central Asia more broadly. I know this is a kind of a complex thing to think about in terms of because, what is Central Asia and where does it begin, where does it end? I mean, we obviously have a sort of standard understanding today that we apply. But if we're thinking historically, trans-historically, it becomes more of an issue because, traditionally we mean the five stans when we talk about Central Asia today. So Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan. Am I missing one? Uzbekistan, did I say that? So yeah, lots of stans.
And people argue whether Afghanistan should be part of it as well.
Yes, Afghanistan as well. And where does it begin? Where does it end? And it extends partially into China as well. Does it go into Iran itself? I know it's a very complex term, but
It's very complex.
fortunately, we do have another term, the Persian, that we could also use,
Well,
which goes even further.
does the Persian mean Central Asia only? We'll discuss that later. Central Asia, well, as you said, what you mentioned is a valid definition. It's a political definition. It's a contemporary political definition of Central Asia. First of all, the word itself, many argue that it is a colonial term. In fact, I believe that a lot of, I would say the majority of region terms starting with central, east, and eastern, southern, northern, and so on and so forth, are terms, concepts, let's say, that have been filtered through modern European academia. And so the term Central Asia, of course, People argue that it is a colonial term, and starting not from the Russians, I think from 19th century Western European explorers and geographers and ethnographers and so on and so forth. And they look at the map being like, oh, that is Asia and that is the center of it. Let's call it Central Asia. So politically, what you said is the definition of Central Asia, but geographically, it again, I'm not a an academic in geography, but I read geographically it refers to the land south to the Eurasian steppes, the southern, more arid lands that that border the Eurasian steppes, extending from, if you want to stretch it, central Iran all the way to Gansu in China, which is just a bit east, more east to the Uyghur region. That is, I would say, that is the geographical definition of Central Asia, because it shares the similar climate and similar ways of organizing settlements due to the climate. Oasis cultures dominate and so on and so forth, and there are vast lands of vast uninhabited land. I would
Yes,
say that
indeed.
is Central Asia, but culturally, well, culturally, I would say Central Asia would refer to Khorasan, so eastern Iran, northern parts of Afghanistan. The southern point would be the northern parts of Afghanistan, and the northernmost part, the southern parts of Kazakhstan, and the westernmost part would be the confines of Khorasan, and the eastern part would be Gansu in China. That is that
Yeah.
would be my definition of Central Asia.
Now, that's an interesting one, obviously. I mean, it's also a kind of a nicer one as well. I mean, the way that, when you talk about politics, the way these countries are often seen through, I mean, much like we've seen the debate over Ukraine and Eastern Europe, which is that there was a tendency for Europeans and outsiders to view these countries through the prism of Russia itself, because obviously everything that happened in the 20th century, and sometimes even the Central Asian republics, are referred to as Stalin's five republics, which is another unfortunate reputation that they've developed. I don't know what else they might use, the territories of the former Mongol Empire. I mean, there's lots of different ways that you can refer to it, but it's kind of interesting. But I think the sort of cultural one is the one we're sort of more interested in today, because obviously, we talk about this thing called the Persianate, which I would argue, sort of stretches, through much of what is today Central Asia, but it goes all the way to, I'd say, Istanbul, because the
Or even
Ottomans used.
further,
You can go further if you want.
from the Balkans to the Balkan to Bengal
Yeah, it's the
conflict.
second language of Islam, they say. So it goes all the way through, in the Middle East, it goes through to South Asia, goes through to, further possibly. I mean, I think Manakia makes this point in her book, the majority of Persian speakers throughout history were non-Muslims, and they lived mostly in India, where the largest contingent of speakers were. So the Persianate, is very much a part of the region. But I wanted to sort of ask this as a sort of starting point: how Persianate is Central Asia, and what did Central Asia mean to the Persianate?
Right. Well, that's a very complex question. I think at the start you made you said that Central Asia, I think you said it was a key part of the Persian world. And I would say Central Asia is the part of the Persianate world.
Well, we've
For
got to protect the Iranian ego a little bit, so
very
because they get quite sad when they find out they're not the center of Persian history, as they've been
well,
taught to believe.
it depending on who's writing history, I think, and especially I suppose with our modern especially let's say westernized perception, we tend to see Central Asia as the let's say backwater region of Iran and Russia and China, but no, it is not. There are many scholars who have argued that Central Asia, well, in terms of Eurasian, at least Eurasian history, it was the cradle of and of a lot of or the center of Eurasian civilization, Eurasian history, actually. I mean, specifically for the Persianate. First of all, new Persian poetry is commonly understood as having started in Central Asia. New Persian in academia, in linguistics, is a term that we use to refer to the Persian after Islam. So we have Old Persian, which was the Persian spoken in the Achaemenid Empire, and then Middle Persian, which was the Persian of the Sasanian Empire, and New Persian. So that's the academic, let's say, chronology of the Persian language. So the New Persian, Islamic Persian poetry, let's say, was born in Central Asia, with namely the poet Abu Abdullah Ja'far ibn Muhammad, known as Rudaki, who was born in Panjrudak, which is now in Tajikistan. He is seen as the father of Persian poetry. Well, of course, that's a very modern term. But the language of New Persian itself very likely also took shape in Central Asia, rather than what is now Iran. I recently attended a web conference, a web lecture given by the French distinguished historian Étienne de Lavessière, who precisely talks about this issue. And according to Professor de Lavessière, the common language, so New Persian, well, the common language spoken in the military camps around Marv, which is now in Turkmenistan, was the main component of early New Persian, of early Islamic Persian. And this would have been a lingua franca, or common language, formed with Middle Persian dialects coming from the Sasanian, well, the former Sasanian space, mixed with Parthian, another very important Middle Iranian language, and with Arabic words. So, in a sense, Persian actually, in a sense, was Urdu, because Urdu means military, right? So, yeah, these were the Muslim soldiers stationed in the camps around Marv, which is now in Turkmenistan, which is in Central Asia. So, Central Asia was the birthplace. You can say that Central Asia is was the birthplace of New Persian idiom and New Persian literature. And also a very important fact, which I think a lot of people will find fascinating and probably don't know yet, is that the earliest surviving written record of New Persian is, well, here I'm not going to say Islamic Persian because it was written by a Jewish person. It was found in 1901 by Orell Stein, who was a Hungarian British explorer who made some expeditions into Central Asia, especially in Xinjiang. It was found by him at a site called Dandong Uyluk, near Khotan, which is now in the Uyghur region, also Central Asia. So this letter, well, it's a letter, and the letter dates back to the late 8th century. And as I said, it was written by a Jewish person, Jewish merchant. It was written in Persian, but in the Hebrew script. And the writer likely belonged to the Jewish community of Kaifeng, which is in Central Eastern China. So yes, well, and many famous cities evoked in Persian poetry, not just Persian poetry, but also Persianate poetries such as Turkic poetry, Urdu poetry, so on and so forth. Cities such as Marv, as I mentioned, Bukhara, Samarkand, and Khotan. People talk about the gazelle of Khotan, Ahui Khotan, right? As a topos, literary topos in classical Persian literature. These are all located in Central Asia, and you also cite cities from modern Afghanistan, for example, Herat, Balkh, so on and so forth. And then in terms of the population, I think the Central Asian population definitely, well, essentially what Persianate is characterized by what I would call the Turco-Persian synthesis, right? Especially under the Islamic empires. And this started from Central Asia. So when we talk about Persianate, we mainly refer to the Persianate Islamic societies, and you know, Persianate Islamicate societies, let's say, started from Central Asia, and that extended notably, let's say, for example, to the Mughal Empire, which ruled the subcontinent, right, and also went westwards to rule Anatolia. The Seljuks started from Central Asia. Yes, so I would say Central Asia is the heart of was and still should be the heart of the Persianate world.
It's kind of funny, actually. I remember once many years ago, I have a friend, she's from Iran, and we were at a sort of a social event, and then she found out there was another woman in the room who was from Tajikistan. And
Right.
because she knows they can speak Farsi, she was like, "Oh, I'm going to go and speak to her in Persian." And I just looked at her and said, "Are you sure you're going to understand what she says?" And she just rolled her eyes at me. "Of course I will. Like, how would I not?" And then she went over there and talked to her. And then she was putting some faces, and then she came back, and I said, "You didn't understand a word of that, did you?" She went, "No, I had trouble." So it was quite an amusing thing. She
Right,
had
right, right, right.
she was knocked down a little when she
There's a
realized she
lot to
couldn't
be.
understand.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said about the mutual intelligibility between different Persian dialects.
I think so. I think you'll find that with a lot of languages that sometimes it's more mutually intelligible one way than the other. I mean, it seems like. I mean, I've seen a lot of Turks, for example, saying they struggle with Azeri, but I haven't seen many Azeri saying they struggle with, Turkish and Turkey.
It's also a very individual issue. It really depends on the individual's exposure to, some people just naturally understand different speeches better than others. This is, I suppose, would be a biological issue as well, and it will be linked to the individual's personal history, cultural exposure, and so on and so forth. And in the Azeri sense, in Azeri case, I would say that most Azerbaijanis. Well, Turkish series are very popular in Azerbaijan, so that is the exposure. Whereas Azerbaijani cultural products are not as popular in Turkey, and speaker's attitude as well. I think if you are ready to understand, if you have the red, if you show a willingness to understand a language. Or let's say a dialect or a variety of language similar to yours, you will end up understanding. But on the point of Tajik and Persian, obviously the division between Tajik and Persian could be attributed to Russian colonialism. But I wouldn't say there's a lot of mutual intelligibility on the sentence level. If you were to, let's say, grab a person from central Tehran who is more used to speaking Tehrani dialects, and a villager from Kulob in southern Tajikistan. If you put these two together, well, let's not say Kulob, let's say northern Tajikistan, the dialects are more different from Asht Tajikistan. If you who isn't educated in literary Persian, If you put these two people together, I don't think they could communicate freely. But the literary form, the standardized form, which, by the way, has always been the well classical, based on classical Persian in both, let's say, nation states. The two forms, the literary forms are, I would say, identical, especially now.
Yes. It's they're united by the script and divided by the actual spoken.
The
So,
script is a different issue, but in terms of the
It's interesting. So, I mean, as you sort of mentioned here, you know, what was sort of relationship like? Because obviously we talk about the Persian, but there's also the Turks and the Turkic civilizations that are sort of emerging, you know, from the same people. Like, what's the relationship like between the Persianate and the Turkic worlds in this same Central Asian space?
Wow, that's a very, very good questions you're asking. Well, I'm just giving my personal opinion. I have personally thought a lot about this. I haven't. This is not my academic field to write about the Perso-Turkic divide, but I have thought a lot about it. And well, first of all, we'll have to sort of go to the definition of the word Turk, right? Many say that many scholars say that its etymology was distributed. Oh, sorry, it's debuted. And did they exist? Well, then we go back to the understanding of steppe nomadic confederations and so on and so forth. And many oftentimes steppe nomadic confederations, which would include Scythian, who are now recognized as Iranian people, confederations. These would not be ethnically homogeneous confederations. The Turk. The term Turk, as perceived as an ethnic term, probably corresponded to a very ethnically mixed or culturally mixed reality, who, nomads from different parts of the steppe, and they decided to group together, ethnically, and culturally, to a certain extent, it would have been diverse. But in terms of the Persianate understanding of Turk, well, first we have to understand that even before the Islamic times, the Turkic populations in Central Asia were, for the most part, living side by side with the Iranian-speaking populations, the most notable of which would be the Sogdians. And there was a lot of cultural convergence. There was a lot of linguistic convergence as well. The Sogdian language, till the very end, was quite Turkicized, and they would live under each other's dominance. Sometimes the Iranian peoples, would living in polities governed by Turkic speakers, and other times the other way around. And but what is important for Persianate is that if we talk about the Persianate within the Islamic framework, I do agree with the view that the way that Turkic speakers in Central Asia became Muslim. I'm avoiding using the word Islamicization, which I see as quite problematic, but the way that Turkic peoples in Central Asia, or in general, became Muslim was through the Perso-Islamic culture, which explains why there are so many similarities between what I would say Islamic Turkic languages. When Turkic languages are a family, all the languages are related to each other, but some languages are more similar to each other than others. Namely, the linguistic continuum, let's say, from Anatolia, modern standardized Turkish is its own thing, I would say. The traditional speech of Anatolia, Western Turkic, all the way to the Caucasus, what is now the Republic of Azerbaijan, and going down to Iranian Azerbaijan, and then going up to what is now Turkmenistan, so Turkmen language, and then Uzbek, and Uyghur. These five Turkic languages, Islamic Turkic languages, are remarkably similar to each other. And I would argue that's precisely because that's precisely due to a large number of Perso-Arabic words that came with the Islamicization through the Persian Islamic, the Perso-Islamic culture. And a lot of obviously Turkic speakers, a lot of Turkic speakers now would what well, a lot of what well, the linguistic shift happened in a lot of areas, you know, on this linguistic continuum, by which I mean that a lot of people who originally would have spoken other languages shifted to Turkic. And then there are many, many reasons for linguistics, for language shift, and this requires a different video, but it is a linguistic, sociolinguistic phenomenon when the community gradually shifts, or suddenly, let's say, in many cases, to another language which they never used to speak, and sometimes not even by force as well. So we have a lot of these cases in history, and which contributes to the mixture of Turkic. And obviously the Persian, the Perso-Islamic culture being the most dominant Islamic culture in the region, when the Turks gained the Turkic speakers gained power, it's very, I mean, it's well attested in the history of mankind, humankind, that when a nomadic power builds an empire on a sedentary area which already had its population. For example, when the Mongols conquered different parts of Eurasia, when the Manchus in the 18th century conquered China, and these nomadic, let's say, social elite would inevitably, probably, perhaps for the sake of convenience of governance, adopt the sedentary culture. And I do agree with the view that the Turks, by governing already, you know, through Islam, they assimilated Persian culture, appropriated Persian culture, but Perso-Islamic culture, and by governing, you know, the Persian or Iranian-speaking geography and population, they were culturally assimilated to the Perso Islamic world.
Yes. So it's a very interesting relationship. But I wondered now if you could tell us very briefly about the work you're doing on Sogdian language. I mean, you've got to tell us. I mean, you've got a people who called the Yagnobis. How do you pronounce this?
Yagnobi.
Yagnobi, and they speak obviously this language there in present day Tajikistan. And I wonder if you could tell us briefly about them, their language, and their relationship to Tajikistan, the wider Tajiki society.
Right. Well, first, I have to say a little bit about the Yagnobi people and why it is very important. I think it's, well, I almost see it as a missing link to how we understand Central Asian history at the turning point of the coming of Islam. Well, now well, the Yagnobi language and people are named after the Yagnob Valley. The etymology of Yagnob has been supposed to be icy water. So ob is water in Persian, and yachn it means ice. Yach in Persian, but some people put the missing link, and I don't know how, I can't remember exactly how the n sound is explained. So there's a valley north in northwestern Tajikistan flanked by two mountain ranges, in the north the Zarafshan mountain range, and in the south the Hisar or Gisar in the Russified pronunciation mountain range. There's a narrow piece of land, a valley called Yakhnob Valley, and European, including Russian scholars in the 19th century, named the people after the valley and their language as well. And prior to the late 19th century, I would say the population within the valley was relatively unknown to outsiders, especially to European scholars. And in the I think the earliest, if I remember it correctly, the earliest recording of Yagnobi speech was made in 1870 by a Russian scholar who traveled there, and subsequently many scholars recorded texts and words and phrases, and one of them being the Hungarian, the Austro-Hungarian scholar Újfalv, Karol Újfalv, and who wrote a little booklet called the Yaknobis and their language, I believe. And it was still not sure at the time in the late 19th century what this language was. In fact, a French scholar called Girard de Rial thought that it was a Dardic language, related to the language spoken in northern Pakistan and northwestern India, so on and so forth. But at the same time already, the German scholar Friedrich Müller recognized that the similarity between Yagnobi and Sogdian, and was and said that this language was well, first he said it was purely an Iranian language. It was purely Iranian, and then he in 1904 he published well he pub he published an article saying that it was related to Sogdian. So it's because of this that the Yagnobi has come to be known, well, has been referred to in academic literature as Neo-Sogdian. And that was very exciting for the, I would imagine, for the Western European academia, because Sogdian was, had only just been deciphered. And of course, the name Sogdian and Sogdia, the territory, were known to Europeans through Greek classics, because it was part of the Persian Achaemenid Empire, and so Europeans would have like a sort of imagination of Sogdia, and also known to the Muslims through the works of Muslim scholars such as Al-Biruni, and also historiography in the Muslim world. But it was believed, and actually a lot of people still say, that the Sogdians, after the conquest of Sogdiana, well, there was never such a country called Sogdiana, this is also a sort of modern term, by Qutaybah Muslim, I think, Sogdians practically disappeared or assimilated with local populations, and those who went to China assimilated with the Chinese population, well, which they did. But on the sort of on the essentialization side, it was assumed that this is how it happened, because people assumed that the Muslim conquest to be was brutal, and those who refused to convert were simply executed, and those who remained were forcibly converted. History is never this black and white. So we can talk about this later. But yeah, so I imagine it must have been very exciting to find a descent, what to find a language related, or even a descendant of descendant of Sogdian. With more research, scholars came to realize that Yahnobi, in fact, is Yahnobi, I would say, well, sorry, you can cut that part. With more research, I think, scholars came to realize that Yahnobi, is probably only related to Sogdian rather than being a direct descendant of Sogdian, because it has more. Has features more archaic than Sogdian, and it is now generally accepted that it is descended from the Yahnobi is descended from a variety, or let's say a dialect of Sogdian, possibly used and spoken in Ustrushana, which is the name of a region that that's between Samarkand and Khujand, very close to Yahnob now, and it's better to see Yahnobi as a niece language to Sogdian, or a sister language to Sogdian, rather than a daughter language. And what was the you asked about? I suppose that was the introduction to this is the
Yes, I
introduction.
said sort of briefly what it was its relationship today with Tajiki society.
Today, right. Today in Tajikistan, generally people have heard of Yahnob and Yahnobis, and I think it holds a very important place in Tajik nation building, because Sogdian and Sogdian culture, Sogdian history, hold a very important place in Tajik nation building, and the essentialization of the Tajik identity does surround Eastern Iranian peoples, but Sogdians in particular. And but at the same time, Yahnobis are not seen as a separate millat. You know, Tajikistan has essentially there's a millat system which is inherited from the. From the Soviet period, and in the Russian equivalent of this word would be nationalist, which doesn't mean nationality, doesn't mean the same thing as nationality does in English. It designates, simply put, an ethnic group. So the Yahnobis are not classified officially as an ethnic group. They are classified as Tajiks. I met a lot of last year during my research. I met a lot of Yahnobis who would straight up say that they were Sogdian. It is very the Sogdian identity is particularly what is very important for Tajik nation building, and especially important for Yahnobis, because they actually do speak a language related to Sogdian. I wouldn't say that that Tajik society centers around Yahnobi culture. In fact, many people have only heard about it, and the name Yahnob and Yahnobi people, but they don't know anything more. I was asked by non-Yahnobi Tajiks whether the language was a dialect of Tajik or whether it's a separate language. So people have, I would say, generally very little information on Yahnobi. But yes, the Sogdian identity, a lot of Tajiks do see the Sogdians as their ancestors.
Yes, indeed, and it's interesting as you're saying this. So it's obviously they do have a certain kind of prominence then within Tajikistan, because my sort of last question, and we can sort of finish on this, is what is the relationship between the local authorities, not just in Tajikistan but in other Central Asian countries? So you can think about Uzbekistan, you can think about others, towards this Persian heritage, because as you've sort of mentioned a few times, obviously you had a period of Russianization as well, which disconnected many of these countries from the wider Persian world, and a lot of linguistical changes came in, cultural changes, political changes, but obviously many Central Asian countries post 1991 develop their own independence, and they start asserting a different identities that are different. So what is the sort of relationship like now and their attitude of the authorities towards this Persianate heritage?
Well, first of all, we have to discuss probably the term Persianate a little bit. We have been using this term in this conversation without actually dissecting it. And I think it's very, very important to realize that Persianate as a term is a relatively new term. It's commonly believed that it was invented by the American scholar Marshall Hodgson in 1974, coined, let's say. And so it is predominantly an academic form. Let's not forget that. It's a predominantly academic form, and it is pre it's a it's predominantly used in the English-speaking academia. And these two factors, I think, are kind of de determine the fate of this term, because when it is an academic term, it doesn't, let's say, penetrate into the public as much. And academic terms tend to be defined and redefined constantly, and people constantly try to sort of find fault with it. And because the term has the word Persian in it, a lot of controversies sort of well, a lot of controversies started, a lot of criticisms of this term precisely center around the word Persian, you know, what it actually means, what it refers to, you know. And academic terms usually are attempts that we as academics make to understand it, to understand or to intellectualize a reality which is easily observable, but usually quite difficult to define. And when this and every linguistic sign, every term is quite formally, let's say, you know, limited in form. And the words some can never capture the vast reality and, let's say, diversity of what we are trying to understand and describe and discuss. So, but because of the limited linguistic sign, and I think if I have to be Saussurean, because of the limited linguistic sign, a lot of, you know, conjectures can be made about it. So, and then and if, let's say, misused by politics, we have many, many cases in history, modern history, when academic vocabulary is misused, misinterpreted deliberately or unconsciously by politics. That can be, such as the term Aryan, for example. That can have very that can have catastrophic consequences on ordinary people. So that's one. Two, we don't even have an appropriate translation of Persianate into other European, usually academic languages, let alone languages of the people, of the peoples of the region that we now call Persianate, you know. And that's due to the particular way that the English language uses the suffix, which comes from Latin, the suffix "ate," which m in English means, you know, resembling or having the characteristics of. But it is not that much used in the same way by other European languages. And we simply, I suppose, haven't been able to found an equivalent in, let's say, Persian or Turkic or Urdu, or so on and so forth. There is a translation in Persian, and I think some Persian-speaking scholars have rendered it as Farsi Zabon, which literally means Persian-speaking, which destroys, I suppose, precisely destroys the purpose of this term, which tries to be inclusive, you know, which is indeed inclusive of non-Persian-speaking societies that share certain characteristics with with Persian-speaking societies, and I think that's very important to realize. Even in, for example, like you can't just go up to, let's say, can you imagine going up to a Pakistani person and say, "Oh, you identify as Persianate." Can you expect the reaction? Most people, I think, outside of academia, are not aware of this, and that is precisely why in Central Asia, well, I would say, hasn't caught on at all. Precisely because of the nature of the term Persianate as an Anglo-centric academic term, and which, let's say, defies translation, right? And with the, as you mentioned, well, one of the negative legacies of the Russian Empire and the Russian dominant Soviet Union that succeeded it, as you mentioned, was the breaking up of the cultural continuum, which we now call Persianate in academia, between the Caucasus, Southern Caucasus, so even a bit of Northern Caucasus and Central Asia, by essentializing through colonial academia, ethnography, and anthropology, historical ethnic designations such as Turk and Tajik and Kazakh and Kyrgyz and you name it, into modern ethnic categories in order to fit the European ethno-national model, and later by policy that from top down sort of consolidated such arbitrary divisions. And these modern nation states, which are very young, by the way, barely, over 32 years old, all these Central Asian stands. And the modern countries are, of course, continuation of this understanding of selfhood. And because of the nationalism, well, Russian, let's say, Western, as 19th century and early 20th century ethnography, defines an ethnicity as, or let's say, as ethnic group, ethnos and nationalist, in Russian, as a group having distinct ethnogenesis, distinct history, distinct geographical distribution, distinct physical appearance as well, and distinct customs and traditions, food and clothes and so on. And this methodology, which has been inherited by contemporary nation states, post-Soviet states, seeks to emphasize the distinction and difference rather than commonality. And for the sake of nation building, even though it is useful, I think, in Central Asian states, as an instrument of decolonization, for example, renaming the main avenue in the capital city by the officially designated a national hero, rather than Lenin or Marx or I don't know, a Russian writer, Gorky, for example. Yes, it is useful as a decolonial tool, but at the same time, I think it ironically it reinforces and consolidates the division, which was never there before, let's say, the arbitrary division, of course, which was never there before Russian colonization and colonialism. So I don't think Central Asian intellectual circles or ordinary people or politicians relate to the term Persianate at all. Some people will be, well, very few people will be aware of this term, especially if they work in Western academia and or have contact with Western academia. But I don't think it's a popularized term, and certainly I don't think a lot of people would like to be Persian if they see the term Persian, because translated into, if mistranslated, which it often is, into other languages, Persianate can very easily become Persianized, and these two are not the same things. So yeah, I'm a bit Well, I would say that they wouldn't. It's still now Central Asian state building focuses on differences rather than shared heritage. There are efforts within there are efforts within ordinary people, let's say in the public, to connect the dots, especially within Turkic speakers. But that is due to another form of pan-Turkism, which is another form of cultural, well, let's say imagined cultural unity, rather than the very well, pan-Turkism is a very ethnocentric, let's say, understanding of cultural unity, which contradicts Persianate, the term Persianate, which doesn't focus on ethnicity or constructed ethnicities and ancestry, but more on the cultural forms. And I think with the methodology of anthropology and ethnography brought about by the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, inherited by the intellectual circles of and the political circles of Central Asia, which essentialize and mythologize nationhood. This term doesn't, and I wouldn't say will, anytime soon have any vitality in Central Asia, especially in the understanding of ordinary people.
Skander Ding, thank you for talking to us at Memo
Thank
Conversations.
you. Thank you.
And to our audience, thank you for tuning in. If you've missed this one and would like to catch up or watch previous Memo Conversations, you can go to our website. But please do tune in next time for more Memo Conversations.
This was Middle East Monitor Conversations, brought to you by the Middle East Monitor in London.